Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, July 20th, 2018. The Kiir administration requests more time for consultations on power sharing.
We decided not to continue with the initialing with all these opposition groups and to wait until we have sufficient time to share the new proposal.
And a government official says there aren't many compromises Juba can make on the power-sharing formula.
The Council of Ministers strongly stand by the team, and the negotiating team in Khartoum is now fully empowered and fully mandated to go back to Khartoum and to negotiate.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's warring parties have failed for a second time to reach a power-sharing deal in Sudan. Sudanese Foreign Minister Al-Derdiri Mohamed Ahmed told reporters in Khartoum yesterday that the government delegation asked for more time to consult with its leadership back home. Some opposition leaders accused the government of derailing the peace process, as we hear from Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The warring power parties were expected to sign a power-sharing agreement on Thursday, but the government delegation requested that mediators give them more time for consultations with President Kiir and his cabinet in Juba. Sudanese Foreign Minister Ahmed says after months of negotiations, all the various opposition groups at the talks are ready to sign the proposal.
We decided not to continue with the initialing with all these opposition groups and to wait until we have sufficient time to share the new proposals with the opposition parties and to find out if it's possible for us to develop now a new presentation or formulation to be presented once again to all of the parties with the view that it might be attending to the requirements of the government and making it possible for the government to join as well.
The top Sudanese diplomat says President Salva Kiir, opposition leader Riek Machar, and the other parties at the talks are expected to sign the deal in the presence of Sudan President Omar al-Bashir on July 26th.
We still look forward to have the final signing ceremony on that date. This means whatever amendments, ratifications or initialing shall take place from the period that continues up to the 26th and not beyond that period.
Some members of the opposition groups at the talks are expressing their dissatisfaction with the government's decision to delay the signing ceremony. Agok Makuru of the SPLM-IO says the government is not serious about finding a permanent solution to conflict in South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, Makur says his group is in the Sudanese capital for one reason.
We are here in Khartoum for search for peace which will achieve security and stability in our country. We are ready to sign peace at any time. Our chairman Machar is ready to bring peace to South Sudan, but we want to make sure that this peace comes with objectivity and just for all warring parties.
Mary Akech, a member of women's group attending the talks, is also disappointed with the delays, but says any deal signed under pressure will not be good for South Sudanese.
I will be very happy to see them working together, that remain a citizen of South Sudan, and should not be an influence behind this peace. It should come as the real peace that the people of South Sudan are yearning for.
Ahmed insists the current negotiations are on a schedule as mandated by the IGAD Council of Ministers last month in Addis Ababa, and says Sudan will continue to help guide the parties toward a solution that will end the nearly five-year conflict in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
Two members of the South Sudan government's delegation at the talks in Khartoum returned to Juba for more consultations today. The deputy government spokesperson says the Kiir administration isn't ready to make more compromises on sharing power during a transitional period. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
President Kiir chaired today's cabinet meeting to discuss outstanding issues at the talks in Khartoum. Lily Albino Akola, the Deputy Minister of Information, told the reporters the Kiir administration is working to restore peace in the country.
The Council of Ministers strongly stand by the team, and the negotiating team in Khartoum is now fully empowered and fully mandated to go back to Khartoum and to negotiate to bring full peace to the people of South Sudan.
Akol says the areas of disagreement includes issues related to the office of the president, parliament, and states.
Throughout the document of the agreement, that office should be referred to as the office of the president, as opposed to it being referred to the office of the presidency.
The various opposition groups at the talks in Khartoum want dissolution of the current parliament and equal power sharing in the state's governance. The government says the power sharing at the state level should end at the executive level. The opposition also wants the number of states to be reduced to 21. Akol says the government will not accept that.
Our team still maintains the position in the Entebbe proposal, that's maintaining the 32 states as they are and forming the inclusive boundary commission to look into the issues of boundary demarcation among these states. Our team continues to maintain that, and there's a strong consensus also from our team that if there's any change in the number of states, this should come from the people of South Sudan in a referendum, because the issue of the states is a sovereign right of the people of South Sudan and cannot be imposed from somewhere else.
Akol says Martin Elia Lomuro, the Minister of Cabinet Affairs, and Aout Deng Achwil, the Minister for Gender, who arrived from Khartoum today, are expected to return to Khartoum for more talks with the opposition. The government refused to sign the draft power-sharing agreement on Thursday, sparking criticism from the opposition groups who accused the government for dragging their feet. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A professor at Juba University's Institute of Peace and Development Studies is criticizing the government's move to extend those talks in Khartoum. Dima Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
Juba University Professor Simon Monoja says the government's decision to buy more time is another setback to the peace process.
It's another nail on the head of the peace process. This is another nail. That means actually that as far as the government is concerned, it's just foot dragging to keep them in control of government in South Sudan as long as possible.
Monoja says if the final draft of the power-sharing proposal limits President Kiir's influence in South Sudan, South Sudanese should not expect an end to the fighting.
Maybe this proposal that was given was in such a way that there was going to be a weakening of certain powers from the government in control. And that's why they're dragging the peace. And that's why they want to come back and consult. What consultation do they really want to have again? This is not the second time or the third time. Every time when they're under pressure, a bit in the negotiating table, then they said, we want to go back and consult. So it is part of the initiative of the government of dragging, and they will continue to do that. So we don't hope for any peace. We are not going to have a negotiated peace. What we probably would have better is an imposed peace.
Monoja says the mediators and the international community must use different methods of conflict resolution to end South Sudan's violence.
So long as there is no pressure, and I mean real pressure, this time a military intervention pressure coming from the neighboring countries or from the international community. If no any kind of serious pressure is coming, this is part of the foot dragging of the government as far as the peace process is concerned. Because nothing will satisfy the government so long as they are in control.
Munoja says there will be no peace through military victory, so the parties must negotiate in good faith.
A military victory only gives suspension, because at one time in future, the other side will come and gain a bit of upper position, and again they will go back to violence and to conflict.
President Kiir's cabinet met this evening in Juba. The meeting's agenda was not released to reporters who camped outside the venue of the meeting. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. More deadly violence at a settlement hosting South Sudanese refugees. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What advice would you give to a young parent?
For a young parent, he should find out how he can sustain the wife and the baby at the moment. Like, he should not sit idle by just waiting or for the mother of the child to be the one to run up and down.
We should focus on our family, because there are so many other factors that will derail our attention from our family. We should have friends, yes, but the friends we should make is the friend that help us to build this family.
I would advise a young parent to, like, they don't know anything about being a parent, visit friends or even ask their own parents how to parent a child, the things to do when they are crying, when they are misbehaving.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Two people were killed and about 20 others injured when fighting broke out between a Ugandan community and South Sudanese refugees at a camp in the town of Adjumani. Eyewitnesses say calm has returned to the settlement after 3 days of violent clashes there. Mengyang David Mayar has the story for VOA from Juba.
Uganda police intervened to restore order at the ILO refugee settlement, but South Sudanese refugees say schools and markets are still closed. Deng Lual is a camp leader at ILO. He says the fighting started over a misunderstanding surrounding the death of a young girl from the host community. He says people in Adjumani near their camp accused refugees of killing the young girl whose body was found just outside the camp.
At 10, on Tuesday, they start fighting. So they start from Block A, they burned 32 houses. After that, police came, DPC, which is the district police commander in Adjumani, he came, and he tell us, don't cross the road to the side of Mahdi. You be in your side, defend yourself. On Tuesday at night, they came back again and burned 13 houses in Block A also. We there, we defend ourselves. They're using hammers, they shoot the youth. We took the youth back and the police was there.
Lual says he later died and the fighting escalated with houses being burned. Property of unknown value was also looted from the local markets. He says Ugandan police were quickly sent to the scene and separated the two communities.
RPC, which is a region police commander, was came yesterday and called the refugee leader that you used to stop the fight. And they went also to the host community to tell the youth to stop the fighting. So this night, there's no more fighting.
Lual says schools and markets remain closed for fear of reprisal attacks. He says one person with the refugees was also killed during the 3 days of violence. This program reached out the regional police commander in Adjumani for comments, but she requested that we call her back. We placed several calls, but her phone was switched off. There are over 20,000 South Sudanese who have fled from South Sudan during the conflict and are now living in the ILO refugee settlement in Adjumani. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
Some Eritrean refugees are setting up businesses in the capital, Kampala, helping them to peacefully coexist with Ugandans. Many Eritreans now employ Ugandans in their businesses. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
In the bustle of Kampala, at the old Kampala Hill, Eritrean refugee Ben Biniam has set up his restaurant. It draws a crowd of Ugandans, Eritreans, and other nationalities.
Biniam, who has been in Uganda more than 20 years, says his Ugandan clients enjoy the Eritrean injera bread, unspiced Eritrean coffee.
Injera has its way of processing. The flour, you ferment it for 3 days. After fermenting it, then there is injera baking machine. We bake it with that machine. As simple as that, nothing added there. So that's why I think whoever eats has no problem. Once they said, whoever likes it. Ethiopian Eritrea coffee is highly consumed there. So the way we prepare it is with a clay pot. 100% organic. Even the pot is clay. That means it's natural. So the tastes differ because of the clay.
He says many Ugandans increasingly crave Eritrean cuisine, and that draws the two nationalities closer.
Since we have been for long here, now it's mixing up with the Uganda. With no problem. Ugandans are eating our food. Eritreans are eating Ugandan food comfortably, as if from one mother. At the beginning, most of them, they even scared to taste. Once they taste the Eritrean traditional food and the coffee, they love it. When I see Ugandans coming and eating the Eritrean food and the coffee, I'm so happy.
Biniam has trained a number of Ugandans to prepare Eritrean food, and most of his employees are Ugandans.
We don't have any Eritrean here to cook the food. All of them are Ugandans. We train them, and Ugandans are very fast to catch. The injera is the very difficult thing. Ugandans are the one baking. We train them.
Many other Eritreans have set up businesses, including nightclubs, pubs, and guest houses. Pub owner Philmon Underbrand is another Eritrean refugee in Kampala. He says most of the Eritreans who fled their country have found a home in Uganda and are doing business without any discrimination.
Because of the peace of the country, no problem. You know, me, I was before in Khartoum, in South Sudan. Actually, the people of Uganda is educated. They are more advanced than the other people. If someone comes from outside, they are really respected people. When you are in Uganda, you feel just like your country.
Lunchtime usually finds Ugandan Irene Kamya at an Eritrean restaurant in Old Kampala.
I always come here because I now get the best I expect.
Ugandan Brian Opio says the Eritrean businesses in Kampala foster social cohesion through culture exchange and have boosted business.
Now we are mixing cultures, which is very good. We are running away from our usual Ugandan cultures, which is healthy.
Uganda's Minister of State for Refugees, Musa Icheru, says the government allows refugees to run businesses if they are capable of doing so.
They are those refugees we call urban refugees. They register with us and tell us we have the capacity to live in the city and fend for ourselves. Some of them can run businesses, some of them can work, some of them can do a number of things that we as citizens also are doing. There are a number of them already in Kampala here who are doing businesses, but we recognize them as our refugees and they have been documented by us.
To be allowed to remain in Kampala, refugees must show they can afford to buy food, parent, and provide an education to their children. Tens of thousands of Eritreans have fled their country's repressive government and forced conscription over the past 20 years. The United Nations Refugee Agency says Uganda is home to about 4,310 Eritrean refugees, most of whom live in the Kampala suburbs. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Uganda says it will keep a social media tax in place despite an uproar from users. Lawmakers began a process Thursday to amend the law that introduced the tax, but only to reduce a tax on mobile money services. Halima Atumani has the details from Kampala.
Users of social media in Uganda will continue paying tax to access online services such as Facebook, Google, WhatsApp, and Skype. After protests in Kampala last week, social media users were hopeful that the government would scrap the daily tax of 53 cents. On Wednesday, President Yoweri Museveni summoned legislators of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party to discuss the tax. Thursday, Finance Minister Matia Kasaija introduced an amendment to the law, but only to reduce the tax on mobile money services by 0.5%. The social media tax, he said, will remain.
Then on the social media, where we say you pay 200 shillings per day per user, and make a contribution.
The social media tax went into effect on July 1st. President Yoweri Museveni said the tax was aimed at curbing gossip online, but users of social media and other online services have described it as unnecessary and an infringement on the right to freedom of expression and freedom to access information. Legislator Robert Kyagulanyi, commonly known as Bobi Wine, is facing charges of inciting the public for leading a protest against the tax. He says young Ugandans will not be placated by a reduction in the mobile money tax.
Now it is evident that government is only trying to buy time so that Ugandans become complacent and used to this oppression, which we refuse. This time as leaders, we are only coming to join the Ugandans because the people raised their voice, which has been and still stands, that this tax must go.
The finance ministry says it has collected about $1.8 million from the social media and mobile money taxes. Many Ugandans are attempting to avoid the taxes by staying offline or using virtual private networks. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
A survey finds that nearly a million people in southern Ethiopia have been forced to flee their homes since April due to intercommunal violence in the Gedeo and West Guji zones. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the International Organization for Migration released its report.
The survey by the IOM finds the overwhelming majority of displaced, or more than 800,000, are living in precarious conditions in Ethiopia's Gedeo zone. The rest are in West Guji's Oromia region. It is not known what triggered the outbreak of violence, although disputes over borders and the allocation of pasture and water resources have long been a source of tension between people in Gedeo and West Guji. The IOM reports most of the displaced in both zones are living within local communities, while the rest are sheltering in ad hoc collective centers such as schools, disused or unfinished buildings. IOM spokesman Joel Millman calls conditions there abysmal.
The buildings and the collective sites that we've been visiting generally are not fit for human habitation and are extremely overcrowded, forcing many people to sleep outside on dirt, rarely with anything but a single sheet of tarpaulin shielding them from the rains, which are in season now. We said food is reported as a primary need in both of the zones that we checked. This is in addition to major shelter needs as well as concerns over the access to safe sanitation.
Millman says IOM teams were able to go to only four of the six districts in West Guji, where people are displaced because of security concerns. He says a more detailed assessment of displacement sites in both zones is underway. He says this should produce better data in terms of how many people are displaced and their needs. In the meantime, he says the IOM is scaling up its humanitarian operation. He says work on constructing latrines, communal shelters, and kitchens is moving ahead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Cameroon's opposition has once again failed to present a single presidential candidate to challenge Paul Biya, who's been in office for 36 years. 28 candidates will be contesting the country's October 7th presidential election, which Biya is favored to win. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
The youngest candidate registered to compete in the October 7 presidential election is journalist Cabral Libi. Just before the filing deadline, the 38-year-old said he was still uncertain if he would run because he could not single-handedly raise the $60,000 required by the Election Commission to run. He says he had to ask well-wishers to help him.
En trois jours, nous avons pu lever plus de 20 millions de francs CFA.
He says he has demonstrated that he is the only candidate strong enough to challenge the incumbent president Paul Biya because he was able to raise over $60,000 from well-wishers within 3 days to pay the caution fee required by Cameroon's electoral laws for each presidential aspirant. Libi is one of the 28 candidates to contest the poll. Two women, Zay Genevieve, an independent candidate, and Habiba Issa, who will run for the opposition UPC party, also registered to challenge the 86-year-old Biya, who has been president for 36 years. Last January, Cameroon's notoriously fractured opposition attempted to unite behind a single candidate. About a dozen opposition parties were negotiating to back Akere Muna, a prominent lawyer who specializes in fighting corruption. Muna pledged a non-partisan platform, but today is running on the ticket of his People's Development Front political party. Maurice Kamto, who was meeting with Muna and the main opposition political party, the SDF, to discuss the possibility of a single candidate, is today running for his Cameroon Renaissance Movement party. Kamto says after discussing with some political parties, he found out that all of them wanted a single candidate, but felt they were the stronger politicians that other weaker parties should join.
Nous pensons qu'il est temps que les hommes et les femmes politiques disent aux Camerounais.
He says he then decided that he, like other politicians who want to run for president, should present to Cameroonians their programs and projects that they will implement if elected, instead of basing their strengths on the religious, tribal, and ethnic groups they represent. The SDF has chosen a 50-year-old lawmaker, Joshua Osi, as their candidate and says it is sure Osi will perform better in the elections if the polls are transparent and fair. The ruling CPDM party has gathered at least 30 of the divided opposition political parties to rally behind its candidate, Paul Biya. Issa Chiruma, president of the Cameroon National Salvation Front, says the opposition's inability to come up with a single candidate indicates how they are divided, and so he will support Biya, who, according to him, is the only one that can bring peace and development to the troubled country.
By declaring his candidature, this is an indication, clear indication, that he sent to the nation and the world that he is the man of his generation. Mr. President, move forward. We are ready to support you.
Cameroon is dealing with attacks by Boko Haram militants in the north, separatist movements in two English-speaking regions, and a spillover of violence from the Central African Republic. Biya has ruled Cameroon since 1982 and is Africa's second longest-serving president after his neighbor Teodoro Obiang-Nguema of Equatorial Guinea. He is seen by many as favored to win the polls. If he does, he will rule the Central African state up to 2025, when the next presidential election will take place. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Abiba by Rex Omar. We've been listening to Rex Omar with the song Abiba. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for being here. Let us know what you like or don't like about our show. You can find us at SouthSudan@voanews.com, or you can reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Have a peaceful weekend and join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.